And the old Chelovec comes by with his bell, Calicola. And you're closing in on her. And it's closing time.
The bell was ringing, it was dark. The park was closing, still she held onto my arm. She was a peasant girl, a pleasant girl, and yes, she drove a tractor on a farm. And as the summer night began, and as the trolley sparked that ran on silver tracks in circles round and round the park, she held my hand, Manhattan hand, and whispered low her five-year plan. Then we depart. Oh, Moscow memories, you haunt me still. Communist memories erode my will. The park was closed, the gate locked shut. We walked the streets, the massive empty streets, alone. And after walking all the night, I took her home, I kissed her once. We said goodbye. She had no phone.
The warning signs were ample. By the early spring of 1932, the peasants of Ukraine were beginning to starve. Secret police reports and letters from the grain-growing districts all across the Soviet Union, the North Caucasus, the Volga region, Western Siberia, spoke of children swollen with hunger, of families eating grass and acorns, of peasants fleeing their homes in search of food.
That's the voice of Anne Applebaum. She's an historian and journalist, and she's reading from her book, Red Famine, about the devastating effects of Soviet policy on peasants in 1930s Ukraine.
In March, a medical commission found corpses lying on the street in a village near Odessa. No one was strong enough to bury them. In another village, local authorities were trying to conceal the mortality from outsiders. They denied what was happening, even as it was unfolding before their visitors' eyes.
Anne Applebaum makes the case that these actions were deliberate, and that the commands, as well as the cover-up, went all the way to the top, to Moscow.
Some wrote directly to the Kremlin, asking for an explanation. Honorable Comrade Stalin, is there a Soviet government law stating that villagers should go hungry? Because we, collective farmers, have not had a slice of bread in our farm since January the 1st. How can we build a socialist people's economy when we are condemned to starving to death, as the harvest is still 4 months away? What did we die for on the battlefronts? To go hungry? To see our children die in pangs of hunger?
If you want to start talking about food waste, you're talking about probably the most productive farmland in the world, the heartland of the United States, that is growing crops that are all essentially either not being turned into food or being turned into bad food. If we were to say, how should our food system look? Our food system should grow the right food, respects the people who are growing the food, stewards the land that is being used to grow the food, and does this in a way that produces good food for as many people as possible.
After we've done our best to reduce waste on the source level, the next step in the food waste pyramid is to feed people.
You can fight against food waste for several reasons. For me, the most important one is feeding the hungry people.
The food that's wasted, that 1.3 billion tons, could feed all of those people.
Now, I'm not saying that the solution to this problem is for us to send our leftovers to sub-Saharan Africa. Of course not. But now, it really is the case that we have a global food system, and when we buy food on the world market and throw it away, we are literally taking food off the shelves of the global food marketplace, and we are taking food out of the mouths of the hungry.
Why do you feel it's important now to write something new? Are there new insights?
So you're right. This is a story that is not completely new. It's been described by many people, particularly by a lot of Ukrainians over the years. But the story, as it has been revealed in the archives, and as not just me, but many other historians have been coming to understand it over the past decade, is a little bit different from what we thought. So historically, or traditionally rather, people describe the Ukrainian famine as the outcome of collectivization. Stalin had collectivized farms in Ukraine. That means, and not just Ukraine, all over the Soviet Union, that means he confiscated people's land and property and houses and horses and tractors, forced them into collective farms. Many people resisted, and a lot of chaos was caused. And people assumed always that the famine was the result of that. And it's true, there was starvation and there was food shortages because of that. The archives have shown also a different story, namely that within this moment of chaos, Stalin made a decision to make use of it. In other words, to make use of the chaos to get rid of a problem. And for him, that was the problem of Ukraine.
Как вы подумаете о нашем городе?
Oh, excuse me, but my friend would like to know how much you enjoy our city so far.
Actually, I haven't been here too long.
Il n'y a pas été beaucoup de temps ici.
Ну, рассказывайте мне, да или нет.
Oh, he want to know yes or no.
Well, tell him yes. It's a beautiful city.
Не кричайте, я слышу.
He says he can shout, don't hear you. Have you seen the palace?
Not yet, but I certainly intend...
Oh, you must, you must. It won't be here much longer, you know. They are cleaning it.
Он на единственный?
Are you alone?
Yes.
No. We are here with you.
Oh, I see what you mean. No.
Yes. How many are we?
Here? Three.
You don't want to count the elevator boy?
Yeah.
Three or four?
Four.
But of course, there's your family.
But they're not traveling with me.
Where?
Where I'm going.
But you're here. How many?
Four. With the elevator boy.
Ah, he is in your family.
No, here.
And here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, our distinguished guest has just arrived.
Have some champagne.
What do you mean?
Come this way.
Gentlemen, port and cigars in the war room. Lord Kitchener will join us presently.
Hurry along.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize...
Gentlemen, please. In these troubled times, besieged as we are on all fronts, there is but one man in whom we can place with complete assurance our faith, hope, and destiny. A man who has won more battles than he has fought. A man who has the confidence of his people. Our generated, veneered leader, our own fighting Jack, Lord Kitchener. Kitchener!
He knocked over the pitcher. He's dead.
You'd better come with us.
We're no longer
safe here. Let's to the Winter Palace, quick.
Oh, it's the ice show.
Und jetzt von der Berliner Eispalast und Festspiel der Punishmänner stets der Genackfischbrothers Hans und Joni.
you taking me?
We don't have much time, and there's a lot you have to know.
Now, listen carefully. If the revolution is to be successful...
Excuse me.
Wait, first thing.
But
there's
no, the revolutionary leadership...
No, no, I was talking about the codification. The codification is the central control. It's
wait, top secret.
Do you want to talk about oppression?
Yeah, I was... No, the protocol situation...
Let me,
all right?
You might, all right, go ahead.
Fine.
I just want to tell you about the expediency...
According to the regulations...
Check.
Right. Everything has got to be done in this time.
You have to have the priority of rank.
Right.
Do you mind if I...
Go. Of course.
There is absolute security necessity.
Got it.
All of these operations...
I'll take it from here. Follow me. Right, Chief.
65.
Check. Check.
Gentlemen. Gentlemen. I won't take any more credit for this victory than necessary. Lord Kitchener did not, nay, will not die in vain, grid willing. Gentlemen. Gentlemen, I as leader will use power like a drum and leadership like a violin. Pick out any idea. Compare ideas with the one idea left, you have no doubt, and without a doubt, we have enthusiasm. Gentlemen, please, gentlemen, to make life hold. It's as easy as a bridge. Now, gentlemen, now that we have attained control, we must pull together as one. Like a twin, keeping the prophecy of power as enthusiasm. All for one!
All for one!
And all for one!
And all for one!
Let me hear it for me!
You're under arrest!
We'll get into that, obviously, in the course of the interview, but I'm curious why you were interested in it. What brought you to this topic?
So I've been working on Ukraine and thinking about Ukraine really since the early 1990s. I first went there when I was living in Poland in the late 1980s. I was a foreign correspondent there, and I crossed over the border into what was then really a Soviet, you know, never-never land. I mean, it was a part of the world nobody had really seen in many centuries, and that was Western Ukraine. And we actually drove over the border and went to see the city of Lviv, which is now well-known, and people visit there, and you can take a plane there. But in 1990, it was very cut off from the rest of the world. And I saw the beginnings of the Ukrainian national movement then, which led to the independence of Ukraine a year later, and have had a fascination with and an interest in what happens to that part of the world ever since.
The story is a contentious story. There's been a huge argument among Russians and Ukrainians, obviously, fight about this, but that's gone worldwide. Why?
I think it's because this is a famine that took place for political reasons. The Soviet Union was trying to eliminate the Ukrainian national movement. It was trying to eliminate many peasants. It was trying to – it wound up with one of the results of it was the Russification of Ukraine. And because of that, it's had a political aura about it ever since. Stalin sought to cover up the famine. There was no discussion of it in the Soviet Union ever after it happened. He even went to the extreme length of suppressing the census. He didn't reveal the real census statistics first in 1937, and then in 1939 they published a fake census. So this was something the Soviet state really cared about hiding. And I think because of that, the story has had an aura about it. To Ukrainians, it became symbolic. You know, this is the story that couldn't be told. And it was only when we are free will it be told. And there was something to that. It was really only when Ukrainians were once again able to talk about themselves as Ukrainians that it was possible to speak about this. It was possible once again at the end of the 1980s. And so it because it has a national and kind of ideological significance, both for Ukrainians and Russians, it's been very hard to write about just as a piece of history. You know, it's just not a neutral piece of history. It's a piece of history that creates a lot of emotion in people.
How much do you say the past illuminates the present?
Well, if you think about it, the past is really something that we're all agitated about a lot of the time. You know, and different pieces of the past seem to come back at different times. I mean, just to take a really different and distant example, you know, one issue that I thought was really over in the United States that we really never would talk about again is the Civil War. You know, who won? Was it good or bad?
This is a very rare recording from long ago.
What is it?
Seems they recorded one of those old-time medicine shows.
News. The war is over! Agricultural South!
Ah, see? Bet you didn't know the South won the Civil War.
Left,
this is Daddy.
Daddy!
Zippy Cowhard would leave his wine cellar undefended in such a dangerous time.
Okay, we don't want this part in here. It gets up to
think
some
of the balls you'll have.
You're too young to think about that, Beulah Balls. Bells.
Okay. We gotta get to the part where they have this amazing vision.
That war criminal!
This is more of the point. Oh, this is bad.
Why, oh, Uncle Tom! Oh. You're back!
Uncle Field Marshal Thomas Lawbury Quadroon, honey! I'm back! And I'm beautiful!
I'm so glad that you're back, Tom!
It's good to have
you. See, there are many, many things that you don't know.
That's right,
everything
Tom.
You know is wrong.
I forgot! You're a free man now.
Oh, this is the best part of the play.
No, I ain't, General. I'm a Spencer. As a professional state well, now. You've been wanting over this kinky old puppet for over 60 years. And now you plan to put your puppet tax. Put it right here. In the bag.
Less for me. And die first.
A new world, honey. Nobody gwan have to be a slave all the time. No more. We gwan take turns. And guess who's joining in now?
So, you know, the same is true of the Ukrainian famine. It's not so much that it determines the present. I mean, I don't think anything is that deterministic. It doesn't cause anything to be the way that it is. But the story of the famine, because it's a story of the Soviet assault on the Ukrainian national movement, it therefore is something that people who are either members of or enemies of the Ukrainian national movement often turn to and remember. Again, it's not that it causes things in the present, but it does show us patterns to be wary of. I mean, for example, this one of the reasons it happened was because Stalin was always worried about Ukraine. He was afraid that events in Ukraine would destabilize the Soviet Union, because they almost had during the Civil War in 1918 and 19. And so he was always talked about, obsessively about Ukraine, how Ukraine was a problem. It could cause trouble for Moscow. And you can see some of that, echo some of that in modern Russia. You hear Putin talk about or certainly act as if Ukraine is a very important place whose independence cannot be allowed because it will destabilize Russia.
Let's actually focus on Stalin for a while. And what is it? Why was he so obsessed with dealing with Ukraine, with sort of holding it back?
We first of all forget that Ukraine, at the time of the Russian Revolution, there was also a Ukrainian revolution. In 1917, there was a kind of Ukrainian liberal national revolution that was meant to create a Ukrainian state, much like Poland was recreated at that time, the Baltic states, quite a lot of European countries after World War I reconstituted themselves or were created anew. So it was not an unusual thing to happen. Stalin at that time was the Commissar of Nationalities, and one of his responsibilities was to make sure that Ukraine did not break off from the Soviet Union. And he was involved in policy towards Ukraine during the Civil War, which was especially bloody in Ukraine and South Russia. And he was witness to a very brutal anti-Bolshevik peasant rebellion that took place in Ukraine at that time. So he knew exactly how radical, how angry, and how anti-Bolshevik, anti-Moscow, anti-Soviet the Ukrainian peasants could be. And he had that in his head for many years, and he would refer back to that time. Others in the Soviet leadership would also refer back to that time. They would talk about the lesson of 1919, and the lesson of 1919 was you have to be very careful of Ukraine. I suppose there's another reason that's important to mention as well, which is that Ukraine was the most important grain-producing
breadbasket
of the Soviet Union. And for Lenin, for example, Ukraine was absolutely crucial to keep Ukraine inside the USSR because we need grain. And the Bolsheviks worried about grain because they knew very well that the Russian Revolution, the first Russian Revolution, had been caused by food shortages. They worried always about that happening again.
His voice was loud but not shrill, a chest voice, a baritone, used to sing the repertoire, quote, not in the church where we married. I love you boundlessly, tortured in unbearable bondage, Warsaw song, awaken, arise, men of labor, bravely, comrades, onward, The happy day of May has come. Rave on, you tyrants.
Vous avez pris
Alsace et Lorraine, soldats de 10 septembre.
Wow,
he sang
that's
some
just a sample.
Very heavy stuff.
Pop songs by Mr. Lennon himself.
Songs. Right, rave on, it's a crazy feeling, rave on.
In 1935, the Institute of the Brain, Moscow, asked Nadezhda Krupskaya, Lenin's widow, to fill in a questionnaire on various aspects of Lenin's mental and psychological reactions. Though no weakling, he was not especially strong. He did no physical work. I recall also that he fixed a fence when he was in exile. When he took a walk, he did not get tired fast. He was agile, preferred going on foot. At home, he constantly paced the room fast from corner to corner, sometimes on tiptoe, pondering over something. Why on tiptoe? I believe partially not to disturb anyone. Also, in emigration, when we rented a room, not to bother the owners of the apartment. But that's only part of it. Evidently also because such rapid, noiseless walking on tiptoe made for greater concentration. He definitely disliked lying in bed. He walked fast. In walking, he did not rock or swing his hands much. He was not awkward, rather agile. He stood very firmly on his feet. He didn't go in for gymnastics. He played Gorodki. He used to go swimming, skated well, and loved to ride a bicycle. While in exile, he used to skate on the river along the banks. The Volga area, where he used to live, had no mushrooms. When I joined him in exile, we frequently went mushroom hunting in the forest. Wow. He had keen eyesight, and when he learned fast how to look for and find mushrooms, he searched for them eagerly. He was a fervent mushroom hunter. Was fond of hunting with a shotgun, and in general, he greatly loved to roam the forest.
Let's go back to the breadbasket concept. Was it, again, a real threat? Would it have destroyed or compromised the Soviet Union? Ukraine was no longer part of the Union. I mean, would they have been starving all over?
Well, they certainly told people. The way this was used is the Soviet state told people in the cities and people not living in the countryside that, you know, we are going to starve if the peasants don't give us their grain. The peasants are holding us back. The peasants are a backward-looking reactionary class.
Peasant characteristics include the following.
Pleasant?
Peasant. Peasant, as in peasants, as in you peasants and similar expressions. Extreme suspicion. Ruthlessness. Unflinching puritanism.
Get your hand off my gas station.
Fundamentalist religiosity.
Oh, what an unpleasant trait.
God is a tree.
God is all the trees.
God is this tree or I kill you ruthlessly.
Boy, you're much more of a peasant than I am.
What happened to your flint, Yoni?
Oh. A dislike for politicians.
Yeah, the snifter is no good. Oh.
Cynicism about who wins in life.
Oh, yeah. the little schnacker one again
yeah.
this time, you know.
I could win any time I want to, but I don't want to.
A fear of anarchy.
Yeah.
A right. passion for order.
Yeah.
And a belief that honesty is best served by severity.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
The kulaks need to be eliminated. I mean, they certainly built up support for their assault on the peasantry in general, the assault on the peasantry in general, but also particularly in Ukraine, by portraying wealthier peasants or so-called wealthy peasants, the kulaks, as enemies who are going to destroy us.
So they instituted a form of, well, collectivization. They did what Soviets do. They sort of made everybody work as one huge unit. That was a real problem for the peasants or the Ukrainians, the kulaks, whatever. What were the Soviets trying to do? Were they trying to rationalize farming and make it more productive, or were they trying to get rid of those people?
So there were two goals. I think Stalin may genuinely have believed that collectivization would be more efficient. You know, you could centralize things. You could have these centralized machine tractor stations that would give out tractors instead of people buying tractors individually. I mean, these are people who really believed in central planning, and they thought that it would work. So that was part of the reason. I think the other part of the reason was political. They tried to proletarianize the countryside to make, because the peasants had a certain kind of independence. They had their own land, they had their own houses, they had their own property. And I think the idea was to make them dependent on the state, make them into, like the working class, into a mass group without their own sources of power and influence. And so collectivization was intended to wipe out any remaining sources of independence or anti-state feeling or even just, you know, private enterprise in the countryside.
And it gets worse and worse. I mean, it starts with one thing, and it just really is like a snowball going down the hill.
Tons of cold, tasty ice cream are eaten at cafes and restaurants, in shops and in the metro, on the streets at airports and railroad stations, and in suburban trains. At any time of year, even deep winter, the popularity of this dainty, both with children and grown-ups, is evident. Tourists in Moscow are often amazed to see that even in below-zero weather, ice cream in cellophane wrappers or sherbet glasses sells like hotcakes. Over 50 kinds of ice cream are made by Moscow's refrigerated items plant number 8 alone. The ice cream makers are ingenious. They turn out cakes, wonderful chocolate and nut tubes, and crunchy horns from fine pastry, all containers for ice cream. In summer, the plant makes up to 90 tons a day, not only for Muscovites. In special refrigerator cars, the ice cream is shipped by rail to other cities and to other countries.
They're into it too, man. See, they're into it too, man. They're into junk.
The demand is heavy enough for ice cream makers to enlarge their plants, install new freezing equipment and production lines, replace their old fruit pulping machines with more efficient ones, and to add new types of ice cream each year. In 1969,
where are they
for
making
instance,
the fruit pulping machines in Russia? I mean, they're really into
they've
it.
They've got
man.
An article
they're
about
really
that, too.
Into
it's
it.
Great. In 1969, for instance, the novelties are apelsinovie, which is pear. Yublnenoye, which is a berry of some sort. Orange. Salut. I don't know what salut is.
And Appelsin is like from a German word or something.
Appelsin.
Like. Yeah,
Appelsin.
Yeah, it is. It's not Russian based.
And Mozaika, an ice cream cake. Flavors for every taste. Raduga, Granat, Visna, and Severnaya Sianye have a delicate taste and are pleasantly sweet or tart. Planeta, Cosmos, and Zolotaya Osin, which means golden autumn, are sweeter and spicier and come dotted with raisins, chocolates, or nuts, or covered with pastry. Let's go to Russia.
Oh, want to go to Russia and get fat. Oh, boy, I like to eat in Russia.
They, you know, first, they're collectivizing. They're trying to rationalize farming. And then, I mean, it moves on until they're actually stealing food, not even trying to create it or produce it, but actually taking it away. How does that happen?
So the collections, the confiscations of food from the peasants actually begins earlier. And this is a classic thing. I mean, during the Civil War, commissars went around the villages and just took food away. Later on in the 1920s, there was an attempt to make a more civilized system, you know, to have the peasants continue to sell grain and have some kind of private even distribution. After collectivization, the state no longer played around with that anymore, and they returned to this idea of just making people hand over a certain amount of their food to the state every year, and then they took the food, of course, to the cities, to St. Petersburg and Moscow, without compensation. During the Ukrainian, in the lead up to the Ukrainian famine in the winter of 1932 and 33, they went farther than that. And this was a moment when these activist teams went around the countryside from house to house, and they took everything. I mean, they took not just, you know, the quota of grain that you owed the state, but they took all your grain. They took vegetables. They took potatoes. They took farm animals. They took almost everything, literally leaving people with no food. So the famine, it's important to understand, was not caused by chaos, you know, or crop shortages or, you know, bad weather. It was caused by people taking food. That winter, the teams operating in villages all across Ukraine began to search, not just for grain, but for anything and everything edible. They were specifically equipped to do so with special tools, long metal rods, sometimes topped by hooks, that could be used to prod any surface in search of grain. Thousands of witnesses have described how they were used to search ovens, beds, cradles, walls, trunks, chimneys, attics, roofs, and cellars, to pry behind icons, in barrels, in hollow tree trunks, in doghouses, down wells, and beneath piles of garbage. The men and women who used them stopped at nothing. Like the requisitioners of the past, they were looking for grain. But in addition, they also took fruit from trees, seeds and vegetables from kitchen gardens, beets, pumpkins, cabbages, tomatoes, as well as honey and beehives, butter and milk, meat and sausage. Olga Tsymbaliuk remembered that the brigades took flour, cereals, everything stored in pots, clothes, cattle. It was impossible to hide. They searched with metal rods, they searched in stoves, broke floors, and tore away walls. Anastasia Pavlenko recalled that they took a bead necklace from her mother's neck, assuming it contained something edible. Larisha Shevchuk saw activists take away beet and poppy seedlings that her grandmother was cultivating to plant in her vegetable garden.
Guy Savoy is one of the best chefs in France, which means one of the best on this planet. My first meal at his Vegas restaurant in 2011 was every bit as good as one would expect from such a chef. The only disconcerting note of the meal was when a vast bread cart was wheeled out, and I was asked which breads I'd want with my courses. Some of the bread looked just like my Ukrainian grandma used to bake, hard, shiny rolls. Looking at all that bread, I thought there was enough on that cart to have prevented starvation in a Ukrainian village. My relatives were starved by Stalin, while I contemplate bread as architecture.
This was something that was intended by the government, by the government in Moscow, to wipe out.
Well, there's no other way to interpret it. I mean, yeah. if you take people's food and then you block the roads, which they also did, they blocked the roads around the Republic of Ukraine and they blocked the access from the villages into the cities. If you've taken their food and you've made sure they can't escape, then people will die. And whoever is carrying out that policy has to know that. I mean, it's important to note there isn't a piece of paper that says, let's kill the peasants in Ukraine, just like there isn't a piece of paper where Hitler says, let's carry out the Holocaust. But these are government policies. They're carried out all over the countryside. People who were carrying them out knew what the impact would be.
Stalin is a key figure here. His hatred or his attitude, negative attitude. So it wasn't as though it was some sort of racist problem for him, that he had a personal objection to those foreigners. This was something that was Soviet policy that they were against.
So think about it. Stalin was a Georgian.
Right.
He was not Russian. And he was somebody who was very sensitive to national differences. He cared a lot about them, and he was interested in manipulating them. And the Ukrainian famine is just one of many, many such stories. I have no insight into his soul, and I can't tell you whether he was personally prejudiced. But he certainly noticed, cared about, acted on, and devised policy around national differences, sometimes designed to exacerbate them, sometimes designed to use them, sometimes designed to eliminate nationalities whom he thought to be a problem.
And Ukraine was certainly one of the biggest of those nationalities.
Ukraine was one of the biggest. Ukraine is the biggest non-Russian state in the Soviet Union by quite a bit. But maybe look, he had an obsession about Jews, and towards the end of his life, there was a purge of Jews in the Soviet Communist Party, and the so-called doctor's plot, Jews in hospitals and in the medical profession. He deported, you know, 1 in 10 Balts from the Baltic states. You know, he was interested in depleting and undermining all the nations of the Soviet Union, and certainly the national elites were one of his most important targets. It wasn't just Ukraine. Ukraine is, as I said, it was the biggest and most important, but it was certainly not the only one.
From witnesses to the Ukrainian famine of 1932-33.
Years later, some of those who survived sought to describe these terrible months in written accounts and thousands of interviews. For others who managed to live through the period, the experience was so awful that they were later unable to recall anything about it at all. One survivor, a child of 11 at the time, could remember things that caused sadness or disappointment before the famine, even trivial things such as a lost earring. But she had no emotional memory of the famine itself, no horror and no sorrow. Probably, my feelings were atrophied by hunger. She and others have wondered whether famine wasn't somehow deadening, an experience that suppressed emotions and even memory later in life. To some, it seemed as if the famine had mutilated the immature souls of children. Some searched for metaphors to describe what had happened. Tatiana Pavlichka, who lived in Kiev province, remembered that her sister Tamara had a long, swollen stomach, and her neck was long and thin like a bird's neck. People didn't look like people. They were more like starving ghosts. Another survivor remembered that his mother looked like a glass jar filled with clear spring water. All her body that could be seen was see-through and filled with water like a plastic bag. A third remembered his brother lying down, alive but completely swollen, his body shining as if it were made of glass. We felt giddy, another recalled. Everything was as if in a fog. There was a horrible pain in our legs, as if someone were pulling the tendons out of them. Yet another could not rid himself of the memory of a child sitting, rocking its body back and forth, reciting one endless song in a half voice. Eat, eat, eat.
There's graphic descriptions. You've got them, and I've heard some of them before, but is there one that particularly strikes you as something that this is like crisis beyond control?
I suppose the hardest things to write about and the hardest thing to read about when you work on the famine are the cannibalism stories, partly because they so often involve madness. You know, people clearly don't know what they're doing. You know, we in the modern world, we don't have contact with people who are starving to death and have been starving for many weeks, and we don't know what that's like. We don't see it very often. And the descriptions that people have, not only the memoirs and the sort of oral history of the famine, but what you read in police reports, because there were police reports of cannibalism. The police would write down what had happened and they would put it in their reports and they would send them to Moscow or send them to Kiev or Kharkiv, rather. And they would be recorded. And you can read in the very blunt language of the police reports these terrible stories. You know, women found with having killed themselves after killing their own children. You know, really hard to imagine tragedies.
It must be hard to confront that as a researcher even. I mean, you have the distance, the objectivity of time, but whoa, here's suddenly a detail.
It's very hard. I've said to a couple of people, this book is harder to write than any of my previous books, and I've written about tragic events before, but there's something about this one. I mean, this is semi-literate peasants dying of starvation. There's really nothing uplifting you can say about it. There is no lesson to be learned. There is no, you know, you don't see the power of human goodness overcoming anything, which you can sometimes see in concentration camp stories. You know, there's stories of people helping one another. So this is really an awful story. There's no question about it. And of course, that means that you have to ask the people who made it happen and the people who carried it out, you have to start focusing on them. Why did they do it? What were they doing?
Now, just before we leave the Soviet famine, I'll tell you that one fascinating aspect of Anne Applebaum's book is the way the crisis was covered internationally. She devotes a chapter of Red Famine to that subject, and she contrasts the critical account of a Welsh visitor who traveled and witnessed the famine firsthand to a very different treatment by the International Press Corps in Moscow. Reporters who feared Stalin or were reluctant to alter their previous accounts of his rise. So they chose to stay silent on the famine that they knew was happening. Political leanings came into it too. Playwright George Bernard Shaw, for instance, was famously a staunch supporter of Stalin. But that young Welshman, Gareth Jones, did speak out. Here is one newspaper account of his efforts.
Manchester Guardian, March 30th, 1933. Famine in Russia. Russia today is in the grip of famine, which is proving as disastrous as the catastrophe of 1921, when millions died, said Mr. Gareth Jones, formerly one of Mr. Lloyd George's political secretaries when he arrived in Berlin this morning on his way to London after a long walking trip through the Ukraine and other districts of the Soviet Union. Mr. Jones, who speaks Russian fluently, is reporting to the Institute of the International Affairs tomorrow. In an interview with the New York Evening Post, Mr. Jones said that famine on a colossal scale was impending. It meant death to millions by hunger and the beginnings of serious unemployment in a land which has hitherto prided itself of every man having a job. This summed up Mr. Jones's first-hand observations. The trial beginning on Saturday is merely a sequel to the recent shooting of 35 prominent workers of agriculture, including the vice commissar in the Ministry of Agriculture, in an attempt to check the popular wrath at the famine which haunts every district of the Soviet Union. I walked alone through the villages and 12 collective farms. Everywhere was the cry, "There is no bread. We are dying." This cry came to me from every part of Russia. In a train, a communist denied to me that there was a famine. I flung into the spittoon a crust of bread I had been eating from my own supply. The peasant, my fellow passenger, fished it out and ravenously ate it. I threw orange peel into the spittoon. The peasant again grabbed and devoured it. The communist subsided. A foreign expert returning from Kazakhstan told me that 1 million out of 5 million have died of hunger. I can believe it. After Stalin, the most hated man in Russia is Bernard Shaw. To many of those who can read and have read his descriptions of plentiful food in their starving land, the future is blacker than the present.
Just to keep it still for a moment, your name, Brad Shaw.
Yeah.
What Brad stand for?
Bernard.
Oh! Oh my gosh! You, George Bernard Shaw, famous author and literary smart guy.
See, boss, Brad Shaw say many time he on the side of right.
That's right.
That because he writer.
Huh. In obvious pun lies subtle secret, Rodonato. Writer responsible for all problems he creates.
Wait a minute, Fooge. You're not going to go pinning this monster rap on me.
There is insufficient seed. Many of the peasants are too weak to work the land. The new taxation policy, which promised to take only a fixed amount of grain from the peasants, will fail to encourage production because the peasants refuse to trust the government. In short, the government's policy of collectivization and the peasants' resistance to it have brought Russia to the worst catastrophe since the famine of 1921 swept away the population of whole districts.